The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Elena Kagan, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 16th, 2018. Bill Barr spent Tuesday testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee on his nomination to take over the reins of the Justice Department as Attorney General, a role he previously held during the George H.W. Bush administration. Barr spent more than 8 hours before the senators, but on this episode of the Lawfare Podcast, we're cutting out all the BS. No repeated questions, no repeated answers, no ums, no uhs. And we took out everything except the national security questions, leaving you just the questions and responses about Lawfare topics that you want to hear. It's the Lawfare Podcast Special Edition, Episode 383, Bill Barr versus the Committee with No Bull.
Are you familiar with the January 11th New York Times article about FBI open inquiry into whether Trump was secretly working on behalf of Russians?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Would you promise me and this committee to look into this and tell us whether or not, in the appropriate way, a counterintelligence investigation was opened up by somebody at the FBI / Department of Justice against President Trump?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think there are a number of investigations, as I understand it, going on in the department.
Have you ever heard of such a thing in all the time you've been associated with the Department of Justice?
I have never heard of that.
Are there rules about how you can do counterintelligence investigations?
I believe there are, Mr. Chairman.
So if you want to open up one against the president, are there any checks and balances?
Not outside the FBI.
Okay. Well, we need to look at that. In terms of people who are actually enforcing the law, don't we want to make sure they don't have an agenda?
That's right, Mr. Chairman.
Do you know Lisa Page or Peter Strzok?
I've heard their names.
But do you know them personally?
No, I don't.
This is a message, August 8th, 2016, a text message. Trump's not ever going to become president, right? Right. Strzok responded, no, no, he's not. We'll stop him. Strzok was in charge of the Clinton email investigation. Ms. Page worked at the Department of Justice. August 15th, 2016. I want to believe the path you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, that there's no way he gets elected, but I'm afraid we can't take that risk. It's like an insurance policy in the unlikely event you die before 40. March 4th, 2016. Page to Strzok. God, Trump is a loathsome human being. October the 20th, 2016. Trump is an effing idiot, is unable to provide a coherent answer. To all those who enforce the law, you can have any opinion of us that you like, but you're supposed to do your job without an agenda. Do you promise me, as Attorney General, if you get this job, to look in to see what happened in 2016?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
How do these statements sit with you?
I was shocked when I saw them.
Okay. Please get to the bottom of it. I promise you we will protect the investigation, but we're relying upon you to clean this place up. FISA warrants. Are you familiar with a FISA warrant?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. During the process of obtaining a warrant, is there a certification made by the Department of Justice to the court that the information being provided is reliable?
Yes, sir.
Are you familiar with Bruce Orr?
No, I'm not.
Bruce Orr was Associate Deputy Attorney General for Organized Crime and Drug Enforcement. His wife worked at Fusion GPS. Are you familiar with Fusion GPS?
Yes, I've read about that.
Fusion GPS, Mr. Barr, was hired by the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign to do opposition research against candidate Trump and maybe other candidates. But we now know that they hired Fusion GPS, Michael Steele, who is a former British agent, to do opposition research and produce the famous dossier. Were you aware that Mr. Orr's wife worked for that organization?
I've read that.
Does that bother you if he had anything to do with the case?
Yes.
Are you aware that on numerous occasions he met with Mr. Steele while his wife worked with Fusion GPS?
I've read that.
Okay. The warrant certification against Carter Page on four different occasions certifies that the dossier, which was the main source of the warrant, was reliable. Would you look in to see whether or not that was an accurate statement and hold people accountable if it was not?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mueller, you say you've known Mueller a long time. Would you say you have a close relationship with Mr. Mueller?
I would say we were good friends.
Would you say that you understand him to be a fair-minded person?
Absolutely.
Do you trust him to be fair to the president and the country as a whole?
Yes.
When his report comes to you, will you share it with us as much as possible?
Consistent with the regulations and the law, yes.
Do you believe Mr. Mueller would be involved in a witch hunt against anybody?
I don't believe Mr. Mueller would be involved in a witch hunt.
What are the circumstances that would allow a special counsel to be appointed, generally speaking?
Well, I appointed three, Mr. Chairman, a special counsel. And generally, when something comes up, an issue comes up that needs to be investigated, and there are good reasons to have it investigated by a special counsel outside the normal chain at the department, someone usually of public stature that can provide additional assurance of nonpartisan.
Do you believe that Attorney General Sessions had a conflict because he worked on the Trump campaign?
I'm not sure of all the facts, but I think he probably did the right thing recusing himself.
I agree. I think he did the right thing to recuse himself. Do you know Rod Rosenstein?
Yes, I do.
What's your opinion of him?
I have a very high opinion of Rod Rosenstein and his service in the department.
Okay. Why did you write the memo?
I wrote the memo because starting, I think, in June of 2017, there were many news reports, and I had no facts, and none of us really outside the department have facts. But I read a lot of news reports suggesting that there were a number of potential obstruction theories that were being contemplated, or at least explored. One theory in particular that appeared to be under consideration under a specific statute concerned me because I thought it would involve stretching the statute beyond what was intended and would do it in a way that would have serious adverse consequences for all agencies that are involved in the administration of justice, especially the Department of Justice. And I thought it would have a chilling effect going forward over time. And my memo is very clear that is the concern that was driving me. The impact, not the particular case, but its impact of a rule over time. And I wanted to make sure that before anyone went down this path, if that was in fact being considered, that the full implications of the theory were carefully thought out. So I wanted my views to get in front of the people who would be involved in and the various lawyers who would be involved in those discussions. So I first raised these concerns verbally with Rod Rosenstein when I had lunch with him early in 2008. And he did not respond and was sphinx-like in his reaction, but I expounded on my concerns. And then I later attempted to provide a written analysis as follow-up. Now, I initially thought of an op-ed, and because of the material, it wasn't working out. And I talked to his staff, and I said, you know, I want to follow up and send something to Rod in writing, but is he a one-pager kind of guy, or you know, how much will he read? And the guy said he's like you. He doesn't mind wading into a dense
legal mess. Don't you think President Trump is a one-pager kind of guy?
Excuse me?
President Trump is a one-pager kind of guy.
I suspect he is.
Okay, just remember that. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so I provided the memo to Rod, and I provided it, distributed it freely among the other lawyers that I thought would be interested in it. And I think it was entirely proper. It's very common for me and for other former senior officials to weigh in on matters that they think may be ill-advised and may have ramifications down the road. For example, just a few months before that, I had weighed in repeatedly to complain about the idea of prosecuting Senator Menendez. I think I made three calls. I think it was two to Sessions, to AG Sessions, and one to Rosenstein. Now, I didn't know Senator Menendez. I don't represent Senator Menendez. No one was paying me to do it. And in fact, I don't support Senator Menendez politically. But I'd carefully watched this case. My friend Abby Lowell was his defense counsel, and it was very much like a line of cases that I had been concerned about when I was AG, and so I was watching it, and I thought the prosecution was based on a fallacious theory that would have bad long-term consequences, and so I freely weighed in at the department. And I did so because I care about the rule of law. And I want to say one final thing on the rule of law, because it picks up on something you said, Mr. Chairman. What is the rule of law? We all use that term. In the area of enforcement, I think the rule of law is that when you apply a rule to A, it has to be the same rule and approach you apply to B, C, D, and E, and so forth. And that seems to me to suggest two corollaries for an attorney general. The first, that's why we don't like political interference. Political interference means that the rule being applied to A isn't the rule you're applying to A. It's special treatment because someone's in there exerting political influence. The corollary to that, and this is what you're driving at, Mr. Chairman, is that when you apply a rule, when a prosecutor is applying a rule to A, you got to be careful that it's not torqued specially for that case in a way that couldn't be applied down the road, or if it is applied, will create problems down the road. And I think the Attorney General's job is both. It is both to protect against interference, but it's also to provide oversight to make sure that in each individual case, the same rule that would be applied broadly is being applied to the individual.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Six quick yes or no questions. Will you commit to no interference with the scope of the special counsel's investigation?
The scope of the special counsel's investigation is set by his charter and by the regulations, and I will ensure that those are maintained.
Will you commit to providing Mr. Mueller with the resources, funds, and time needed to complete his investigation?
Yes.
Will you commit to ensuring that Special Counsel Mueller is not terminated without good cause, consistent with department regulations?
Absolutely.
If Special Counsel Mueller makes any request, for instance, about the scope of his investigation or resources for his investigation, will you commit to notifying Congress if you deny that request?
I think the regulations require notification of Congress if there's a disagreement.
Thank you. And I have two questions from the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Will you commit to making any report Mueller produces at the conclusion of his investigation available to Congress and to the public?
As I said in my statement, I am going to make as much information available as I can, consistent with the rules and regulations that are part of the special counsel regulations.
Will you commit to making any report on the obstruction of justice public?
That's the same answer.
Thank you. In your June 2018 memo about obstruction of justice to the Mueller investigation, you repeatedly referred to Mueller's, quote, sweeping and all-encompassing interpretation of Section 1512, which is a statute on obstruction. How do you know what Mueller's interpretation of 1512 is?
Well, as I said, I was speculating. I freely said at the beginning, I was writing in the dark, and we're all in the dark. Every lawyer, every talking head, everyone who thinks about or talks about it doesn't have the facts.
So I spent my Saturday reading that memorandum.
Yeah.
So are you saying this is all your speculation? It's a big memo.
Well, it was informed to the extent that I thought that was one of the theories being considered. And I don't know how seriously, whether it was being considered or how seriously it was being considered. But I as a shorthand way in the memo of referring to what I was speculating might be the theory, I referred to it as Mueller's theory, rather than go in every time I mention it, say, well, this
so
is speculative.
Do you know what Mueller's interpretation of 1512 is?
No, I don't know what Mueller's interpretation.
Okay.
But and just one point, Senator. I think you said in your opening statement, I said he was grossly irresponsible. I think I said if something happens, it would be grossly irresponsible. I was not calling Mueller grossly irresponsible.
I understand. Thank you. I appreciate that. Has anyone given you non-public information about Mueller's investigation?
I don't recall getting any confidential information about the investigation.
Your 2018 in it, you stated, and I quote, "The framers' plan contemplates that the president's law enforcement powers extend to all matters, including those in which he had a personal stake," end quote. Please explain what you base this conclusion on.
Yes. Here's the Department of Justice right here. And within the Department of Justice, enforcement decisions are being made. The president's over here. And I think of it as there are two categories of potential communications. One would be on a case that the president wants to communicate about that he has no personal interest in, no political interest in. Let's say the president's concerned about Chinese stealing trade secrets and say, I want you to go after this company that's being, you know, that may be stealing trade secrets. That's perfectly appropriate for him to do. To communicate that. But whether it's bona fide or not, the Department of Justice's obligation and the Attorney General's obligation is not to take any action unless the Department of Justice and the Attorney General, reach their own independent conclusion that it is justified under the law. And regardless of the instruction. And that's my quote that everyone is saying, you know, I'm sicking the, you know, it's okay for the president to direct things. All I said was, it's not per se improper for the president to call on the department for doing something, especially if he has no personal or political interest in it. The other category of cases, and let's pick an easy bad example, would be if a member of the president's family or a business associate or something was under investigation and he tries to intervene. He's the chief law enforcement officer, and you could say, well, he has the power, but that would be a breach of his obligation under the Constitution to faithfully execute the laws. So, in my opinion, if a president attempts to intervene in a matter that he has a stake in to protect himself, that should first be looked at as a breach of his constitutional duties. Whether it also violates a statute, depending on what statute comes into play and what all the facts are.
Including the emollients clause of the Constitution.
I think there's a dispute as to what the emoluments clause relates to. I have not personally researched the emoluments clause. I can't even tell you what it says at this point. Off the top of my head, I would have said, well, emoluments are essentially a stipend attached to some office, but I don't know if that's correct or not. But I'm sure, I think it's being litigated right now.
I don't know either, so I'm going to try and find out. We'll come back another day and maybe discuss it. Your memo stated a fatal flaw in Mueller's interpretation of 1512C2 is that while defining obstruction solely as acting corruptly, Mueller offers no definition of what corruptly means. My understanding is that there's nothing in the public record that sheds light on his definition of obstruction. Do you know what his definition is?
I don't know what his definition is. I read a book where people were asking whether someone was, I don't know if it was accurate, but whether someone, the president, was acting with corrupt intent. And what I say in my memo is actually people don't understand what the word corruptly means in that statute. It's an adverb, and it's not meant to mean with the state of mind. It's actually meant the way in which the influence or obstruction is committed. That's its adverbial function in the statute. And what it means is, using it in the 19th century sense, it meant to influence it in a way that changes something that's good and fit to something that's bad and unfit, namely the corruption of evidence or the corruption of a decision maker. That's what the word corruptly means, because once you dissociate it from that, it really means very hard to discern what it means. It means bad. What does bad mean?
Let me go on, because my time is so limited. You argue that and I quote, the Constitution's plenary grant of those powers to the president also extends to the unitary character of the executive branch itself. Specifically, you argue, and this is a quote, while Mueller's immediate target is the president's exercise of his discretionary powers, his obstruction theory reaches all exercises of prosecutorial discretion by the president's subordinates, from the attorney general down to the most junior line prosecutor, end quote. So, if the president orders the attorney general to halt a criminal investigation for personal reasons, would that be prohibited under your theory?
Prohibited by what?
By
the Constitution.
The Constitution.
I think it would be a breach of the president's duties to faithfully execute the law. It'd be an abuse of power. Whether it would violate a statute depends on all the facts and what statute someone would cite me to. But I certainly think it would be an abuse of his power. And let me just say that the position—
Would that be the same thing if an attorney general fired U.S. attorneys for political reasons?
No, because U.S. attorneys are political appointments.
According to news reports, President Trump interviewed you and asked you to be part of the legal team defending him in the Mueller investigation twice, first in the spring of 17, when the investigation was just beginning, and again earlier this year. Is that correct?
No. I had one conversation with him that related to his private representation, and I can describe that for you. That was in June of 2017. That's the only time I met him before I talked to him about the job of attorney general, which obviously is not the same as representing him.
Have you discussed the Mueller investigation with the president or anyone else in the White House?
I discussed the Mueller investigation, but not in any particular substance. I can go through my conversations with you if you want.
Well, not at this time, but I may come back to you and ask you about that. I don't want to take any more time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll take the time away from my second round. I'm very curious about the conversations you had about personal representation being attorney general. You mentioned it to Senator Feinstein. Can you kind of give us a summary of what you were talking about?
Yeah, so in June of 2017, middle of June, Ambassador David Friedman, who's the U.S. ambassador to Israel, who I didn't know. I knew that he was a top-tier lawyer in New York and apparently a friend of the president's. He reached out to me, and we talked one evening, and he said that my understanding was he was interested in finding lawyers that could augment the defense team. And failing that, he wanted to identify Washington lawyers who had experience, broad experience that whose perspective might be useful to the president's. And he asked me a number of questions like, what have you said about the president publicly? Do you have any conflicts and so forth? And I told him that I didn't think I could take this on, that I had just taken on a big corporate client that was very important to me and expected a lot of work. And I said at my point in life, I really didn't want to take on this burden and that I actually preferred the freedom to not have any representation of an individual, but just say what I thought about anything without having to worry about that. And I said my wife and I were sort of looking forward to a bit of respite, and I didn't want to stick my head into that meat grinder. He asked me if I would nonetheless just briefly go over the next day to meet with the president. And I said, sure, I'll go and meet with the president. And he brought me over and was squeezing me in. It looked to me like it was before the morning staff meeting because people were grouping by the door to get in, and I went in. And he was there. The ambassador was there, sat through the meeting. It was a very brief meeting where essentially the president wanted to know. He said, oh, Bob Mueller. How well do you know Bob Mueller? And I told him how well I knew Bob Mueller and how, the Barrs and Muellers were good friends and would be good friends when this is all over and so forth. And he was interested in that, wanted to know, what I thought about, Mueller's integrity and so forth and so on. And I said, Bob is a straight shooter and should be dealt with as such. And he said something to the effect like, so are you envisioning some role here? And I said, actually, Mr. President, right now I couldn't do it. My personal and my professional obligations are such that I'm unable to do it. So he asked me for my phone number. I gave it to him, and I never heard from him again until...
Well, I tried that once. You did better.
Well, I didn't hear from him until, later, but about something different, which was the attorney general position.
So will you commit, if confirmed, to both seeking and following the advice of the department's career ethics officials on whether you must recuse from the special counsel's investigation?
I will seek the advice of the career ethics personnel, but under the regulations, I make the decision as the head of the agency as to my own recusal. So I certainly would consult with them, and at the end of the day, I would make a decision in good faith based on the laws and the facts that are evident at that time.
Same thing if you're talking about a conflict of interest?
Well, no. Some conflicts, as you know, are mandatory.
I'm thinking what Attorney General Sessions, and when asked a similar question, he said he'll seek and follow the advice. Seek and follow the advice of the Department of Justice's designated ethics officials. So let me ask you, maybe in a different way. I know you promised to not interfere with the special counsel. Are there any circumstances that would cause you to terminate the investigation or any component of it or significantly restrict its funding?
Under the regulations, Bob Mueller could only be terminated for good cause. And I, frankly, it's unimaginable to me that Bob would ever do anything that gave rise to good cause. But in theory, if something happened that was good cause, for me, it would actually take more than that. It'd have to be pretty grave, and the public interest would essentially have to compel it, because I believe right now the overarching public interest is to allow him to finish.
I would agree with that, but I also think over the past 18 months, you rather harshly prejudge the investigation in some of your writings.
Well, I don't see that at all, Senator. When you strip away a lot of the rhetoric, The two things that have been thrown up as me sort of being antagonistic to the investigation are two things. One, a very mild comment I made that, gee, I wish the team had been more balanced. I wasn't criticizing Mueller. I believe that prosecutors, and I think you would agree, they can handle the case professionally, whatever their politics are. They, a good prosecutor can leave their politics at the door and go in and do the job. And I think that's what Justice Department prosecutors do in general.
But you also are very critical of the Russian probe. And, I mean, I can't think of anything that would, in your memo, for example, that would jump out more for this president because of his commitment to it. And I ask that because some have said on both sides of the aisle that it looked like a job application. And so that's what I want you to refer to.
Well, that's ludicrous. If I wanted the job and was going after the job, there are many more direct ways of me bringing myself to the president's attention than writing an 18-page legal memorandum,
or
sending it to the Department of Justice and routing it to other...
But also publicly criticize the Russian probe. I mean,
how have I criticized the Russian probe?
You don't have any criticism of the Russian probe?
Not at all. I think I believe the Russians interfered or attempted to interfere with the election, and I think we have to get to the bottom of it.
So you would be in favor of releasing the investigative report when it's completed?
As I've said, I'm in favor of as much transparency as there can be, consistent with the rules and the law.
Do you see a case where the president could claim executive privilege and say that parts of the report could not be released?
Well, I don't have a clue as to what would be in the report. The report could end up being, not very big. I don't know what's going to be in the report. In theory, if there was executive privilege material that to which an executive privilege claim could be made, it might, someone might raise a claim of executive
privilege. That'd be pretty difficult following U.S. versus Nixon when the Supreme Court unanimously rejected President Nixon's claims of executive privilege over the Watergate tapes. But I ask him because the president's attorney, Mr. Giuliani, said the president should be able to correct the Mueller report before any public release. So, in other words, he could take this investigative report, put his own spin on it and correct it before it's released. Do you commit that would not happen if you were Attorney General?
That will not happen.
Thank you. Do you believe a president could lawfully issue a pardon in exchange for the recipient's promise to not incriminate him?
No, that would be a crime.
Thank you. In 1990, you argue that Congress appropriation power is not an independent source of congressional power to control the allocation of government resources. There are only three committees in the Senate to have a vice chairman. Appropriations is one of them. Obviously, as vice chairman, I kind of looked at that. You claim that if a president finds no appropriated funds within a given category, he may use funds from another category, as long as both categories are in his constitutional purview. Now, this is Vice Chairman Appropriations Committee. Don't be surprised, I disagree. Congress is power of the purse, Article 1, Section 9. I believe Congress is one of the most fundamental and foundational checks and balances on the executive branch. So do you believe the president can ignore Congress appropriations allocations, conditions, and restrictions in law, just ignore them and take the money and transfer?
Not as a general proposition, but that was a...
A general proposition.
I actually thought that was a good law review article. I gave it as a speech, and it was really a thought piece. And what I was really saying was, and I say right up front, that the more I thought about the appropriations power, the more confused I got. And I was just laying out a potential template, which is this. People frequently say, you know, the power to, you know, spend money on this division or this missile system is part of the power of the purse. And what I was actually saying was, you know, actually what the power being exercised there is the substantive power that Congress has to raise armies. And it's not, it doesn't come from the power
of specific appropriations on agriculture or on defense. I mean, for example, could a president just build a wall along our southern border because he wanted to and just take the money, whether appropriated or not? What about eminent domain?
What about eminent domain?
Well, if you're going to build a wall, you got to take a whole lot of land away from landowners in Texas and elsewhere.
Well, you know, you'd have to show me what statute is being invoked and also what appropriations is being used. I can't answer that in the abstract.
So you're saying the president, though, can have the power to go into money even if the Congress is appropriated for a different purpose?
I didn't say that. But some I don't mean that. I'm saying that, there are monies that the president may have power to shift because of statutory authority.
But that would have been because Congress gave him that authority.
Right.
Not because he has it automatically.
I'm not taking that position. As I said, my law review, it was published as a law review article, and it was a thought piece exploring what limits there might be to the appropriations power and what where Congress's power comes from in certain areas.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just to follow up on that real quick, and I won't take this against their corner. Did the Article II powers, the inherent authority of the Commander-in-Chief, give him the ability to take appropriated dollars for the Department of Defense and build a wall?
I can't. Without looking at the statute, I really couldn't answer that.
I'm not talking about a statute. I'm talking about the inherent authority of the president, as Commander-in-Chief.
That's the kind of question I would go to OLC to answer.
Okay. Get back with us on that, Senator Corn.
And thinking back to James Comey's press conference of July the 7th, 2016, where he took the step of talking about the evidence against Mrs. Clinton, talking about the legal standard that would apply as to whether she might or might not be indicted for committing a crime under the Espionage Act, have you ever seen a situation where an FBI director would usurp the authority of the Department of Justice to make that charging decision and hold a press conference and talk about all of the derogatory information that the investigation had gleaned against a potential defendant and then say, now we're not going to, no reasonable prosecutor would indict her? Have you ever seen anything like that happen before?
No, I've never seen that. And I thought it was a little bit, more than a little bit, it was weird at the time, but my initial reaction to it was, I think Attorney General Lynch had said something, you know, she was under pressure to recuse herself, I think, because of the so-called tarmac meeting.
Right.
And I think she said something like she was going to defer to the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
So my initial reaction to that whole thing was, well, she must have agreed, or it must have been the plan, that he was going to make the decision and go out and announce his decision.
Under the normal rules, if the attorney general has a conflict of interest,
it would go to the deputy.
It would go to the deputy,
correct?
Not to the FBI director to make that decision, correct?
Right. So that's why I thought it was very strange. But I think later it became clearer, to the extent there's anything clear about it, that I don't think Attorney General Lynch essentially delegated that authority to the director. And I think Jim Comey is, as I've said, an extremely gifted man who's served the country with distinction in many roles. But I thought that to the extent he actually announced a decision was wrong. And the other thing is, if you're not going to indict someone, then you don't stand up there and unload negative information about the person. That's not the way the Department of Justice does business.
I was shocked when Mr. Comey later wrote a letter saying that based on the discovery of Clinton emails on the Wiener laptop, that they were reopening the investigation that he had already announced closed. And then finally, just days before the general election, November the 6th, 2016, said, we didn't find anything in the on the laptop that would change my conclusions based on the press conference of July the 6th. Did you likewise find that to be an extraordinary, I will use the word bizarre, but certainly unprecedented event?
Yeah, the whole sequence was very herky-jerky and bizarre. But at that time, I was a little of a contrarian in that I basically took the position that once he did what he did in July and said the thing was over, and then found out it wasn't over, he had no choice but to correct the record. So I said that he had no choice but to do what he did. But it sort of shows you what happens when you start disregarding the normal procedures and established practice, is that you sort of dig yourself a deeper and deeper hole.
Rod Rosenstein's memo recommending the termination of James Comey as FBI director was dated May the 9th, 2017. It's entitled Restoring Public Confidence in the FBI. I take it you've read the memo, and do you agree with its conclusion?
I completely agree with Rod Rosenstein. And I thought the important point he made from my standpoint was not the particular usurpation that occurred, but it was, as I think he says, that Director Comey just didn't recognize that that was a mistake, and so it was going to potentially be a continuing problem, that his appreciation of his role vis-a-vis the Attorney General.
As I said, the title of the memo is Restoring Public Confidence in the FBI. Do you agree that restoration of public confidence in the FBI and Department of Justice as a apolitical or nonpolitical law enforcement organization is important?
It's critical.
And needed.
It's critical, and that's one of the reasons I'm sitting here. I'd like to help with that process.
Why do you want this job?
Well, because I love the department. I love and all its components, including the FBI. I think they're critical institutions that are essential to preserving the rule of law, which is the heartbeat of this country. And I'd like to think that there was bipartisan consensus when I was last in this position, that I acted with independence and professionalism and integrity, and I had very strong and productive relationships across the aisle, which were important, I think, to trying to get some things done. And I feel that I'm in a position in life where I can provide the leadership necessary to protect the independence and the reputation of the department and serve in this administration. I am not going to do anything that I think is wrong, and I will not be bullied into doing anything I think is wrong by anybody, whether it be editorial boards or Congress or the president. I'm going to do what I think is right.
I recognize Senator Whitehouse.
Did you request or signal or otherwise communicate in any way that you wanted Rod Rosenstein to go?
No, the president said that the decision on the deputy was mine. Anything I wanted to do on the deputy was
fine.
So
we will find no William Barr fingerprints on Rosenstein's departure?
No, Rod and I have been talking, about his plans. He told me that he viewed it as a two-year stint and would like to use, if I'm confirmed, my coming in as an occasion to leave. But we talked about the need for a transition, and I asked him if he would stay for a while, and he said he would. And so as of right now, I would say he has no concrete plans. I have no concrete plans in terms of his departure.
And you
we're going to sort of play it by ear and see what makes sense.
And you have not undertaken to run him out in any way?
Absolutely not.
What is your understanding right now of who at the Department of Justice is authorized to have communications with the White House regarding
investigations? Well, it depends what it is, but on criminal matters, I would just have the AG and the deputy.
And what do you think the rule is now in the department?
I think that's what it is.
Okay. So if the reports are true that as chief of staff, Mr. Whitaker was involved in conversations with the White House about bringing criminal investigations against the president's political enemies, that would not be consistent with your understanding of that policy.
Well, it would depend upon, you know, what his understanding is with the attorney general. I mean,
the attorney general was recused, so hard to step into the shoes of a recused attorney general on that matter, right?
Well, I don't know what the communications related to. I'm not really sure what you're talking about.
Okay.
Senator Klobuchar. We obviously have the tragic case of a journalist who worked right here at the Washington Post, Jamal Khashoggi, and it's a particular concern. So I want to ask you something I ask Attorney General Sessions. If you're confirmed, will the Justice Department jail reporters for doing their jobs?
I think that, I know there are guidelines in place, and I can conceive of situations where, as a last resort, and where a news organization has run through a red flag or something like that, knows that they're putting out stuff that will hurt the country, there might be there could be a situation where someone would be held in contempt. But
well, Attorney General Sessions had said he was going to look at potentially changing those rules at one point. So I'd like you to maybe respond in writing to this, because that was very concerning. And
Senator Coons,
do you want Special Counsel Mueller to shield no one and prosecute the case regardless of who is affected?
I want. Special Counsel Mueller to discharge his responsibilities as a federal prosecutor and exercise the judgment that he's expected to exercise under the rules, and finish his job.
Senator Kennedy followed up by asking Richardson if the special prosecutor would have the complete authority and responsibility for determining whom he prosecuted and at what location. Richardson said simply, yes. Would you give a similar answer?
No, I would give the answer that's in the current regulations, which is that the special counsel has, broad discretion, but the acting attorney general in this case, Rod Rosenstein, can ask them about major decisions, and if they disagree on a major decision, and if after giving great weight to the special counsel's position, the acting attorney general felt that it was so unwarranted under established policies that it should not be followed, then that would be reported to this committee.
I've got seven minutes left. I have a number of other questions. Let me just make sure I understand you. Senators asked Elliot Richardson what he would do if he disagreed with the special prosecutor. Richardson testified to the committee, the special prosecutor's judgment would prevail. That's not what you're saying. You have a difference of opinion with Special Counsel Mueller. You won't necessarily back his decision. You might overrule it.
I under the regulations, there is the possibility of that, but this committee would not, would be aware of it. You know, a lot of water has gone under the dam since Elliot Richardson, and a lot of different administrations on both parties have experimented with special counsel arrangements. Existing rules, I think, reflect the experience of both Republican and Democratic administrations and strike the right balance. They are put together in the Clinton administration after Ken Starr's investigation.
That's right. So the current regulations on the books right now prevent the attorney general from firing without cause the special counsel. They require misconduct, dereliction of duty, incapacity, conflict. Will you follow that standard?
Of course.
What if the president asked you to rescind or change those special counsel regulations?
I think those special counsel regulations should stay in place for the duration of this investigation. And we can do a postmortem then, but I have no reason to think they're not working.
So most famously, when directed by President Nixon to fire the special counsel, the prosecutor investigating Watergate. Richardson refused and resigned instead, as we all well know. If the president directed you to change those regulations and then fire Mueller, or simply directly fired Mueller, would you follow Richardson's example and resign instead?
Assuming there was no good cause?
Assuming no good cause.
I would not carry out that instruction.
Let me bring us forward to your 1991 hearing in front of this committee. You explained at the time how you would handle the BCCI case, and ironically, Robert Mueller, the same individual, was at that point the head of the criminal division. And you testified that you had directed Mueller to spare no resources, use whatever resources are necessary, and pursue the investigation as aggressively as possible and follow the evidence anywhere and everywhere it leads. Would you give similar direction to Robert Mueller today?
I don't think he needs that direction. I think that's what he's doing.
You also said at that hearing that Robert Mueller in that investigation had full cooperation, full support, and carte blanche. Could he expect a similar level of support from you as Attorney General?
Yeah, he will. As I said, I'm going to carry out those regulations, and I want him to finish this investigation.
I think we all do. And I am encouraged by things you've said about this and just want to make sure we've had as clear a conversation as we can. Attorney General Richardson also testified the relationship between the president and the Justice Department should be arm's length. You've said similar things about the importance of shielding the department from political influence. Can you make a similar commitment to us to maintain an arm's length relationship between the Justice Department and the president regarding the special counsel investigation and other investigations?
Yeah, well, remember I said that there are like three different functions generally that the attorney general performs. Mm-hmm. I think on the enforcement side, especially where matters are of either personal or political interest to people at the White House, then there would be an arm's length relationship. The White House counsel can play a constructive role in that as well.
Let me ask if the president asked for information that could well be used to interfere with the special counsel investigation, to misdirect or curtail it in some way, would you give it to him?
No, I mean, there are rules on what kind of information can flow and what kind of communications can go between the White House. And, you know, I would follow those. But the basic principle is that the integrity of an investigation has to be protected. There are times where you can share information that wouldn't threaten the integrity of an investigation, like, for example, when I was Attorney General and we were investigating something that related to someone who had a relationship with President Bush, I could just orient them that, you know, there's going to be a story tomorrow that, you know, says this. But in that particular case, there was no chance that it would affect the investigation. So sometimes judgment calls are necessary.
If you learn that the White House, not directly through you, but through other means, was attempting to interfere with the investigation, would you report that information to the special counsel and to Congress?
Well, there's some conclusions in there about interfering, you know, and if I thought something improper was being done, then I would deal with it as Attorney General.
Last, in that confirmation hearing back in 1973, then-Senator Birchbaugh of Indiana asked Richardson, suppose the prosecutor determines it's necessary to get the president's affidavit or to have his testimony personally. Would that be the kind of determination he, the special prosecutor, could make? Richardson said, yes. Will you give a similar answer today that you won't interfere with Special Counsel Mueller seeking testimony from the president?
As I say, the regulations currently provide some avenue if there's some disagreement. I think that in order to overrule Mueller, someone would have to the attorney general or the acting attorney general would have to determine, after giving Mueller's position great weight, that it was so unwarranted under established policies that it should not be done. So that's the standard I would apply. But I'm not going to surrender the regulations give some responsibility to the Attorney General to have this sort of general supervision, not day-to-day supervision, but sort of be there in case something really transcends the established policies. I'm not surrendering that responsibility. I'm not pledging it away.
What gives me pause and sort of led me to this line of questioning, Mr. Barr, was that June 2018 memo you sent to the Deputy Attorney General, in which at one point you state Mueller should not be permitted to demand the president submit to interrogation about alleged obstruction. If the special counsel wants to subpoena the president's testimony to ask questions about obstruction, and you're supervising the investigation, would you rely on that theory to block the subpoena?
Well, the question for me would be, what's the predicate? You know, and I don't know what the facts are. I don't know what the facts are. And if there was a factual basis for doing it, and I couldn't say that it violated established policies, then I wouldn't interfere. But I don't know what the facts are.
Senator Sass.
How should the American people think about what the Mueller investigation is about?
I think that there were allegations made of Russian attempts to interfere in the election. And there were allegations made that some Americans were in cahoots with the Russians. And the word is now being used is collusion. And as I understand it, Mueller is looking into those allegations.
Is Putin a friend or a foe? And what are his long-term objectives toward the U.S.?
Well, I don't hold myself out as a foreign policy expert, but I think that he is. I think the Russians are a potent rival of our country, and his foreign policy objectives are usually directly contrary to our goals. I think he wants to weaken the American alliances in Europe, and he also wants to become a player in the Middle East, more of a player in the Middle East. A lot of his foreign policy objectives are at odds with ours. At the same time, I think the primary rival of the United States is China. I think, you know, Russia is half the size it was when we were facing them at the peak of the Cold War. Their economy is, long-term prognosis is nowhere near China's. I also feel that part of what Russia's up to is trying to hold on to Ukraine and Belarus in their orbit. But I'm concerned that the fixation on Russia did not obscure the danger from China.
Because I'd love to have you say in public some of what you said to me about at the end of this investigation, what happens next? Are you concerned that when the Mueller report is received, quite apart from the narrowest pieces, you know where I'm headed?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the basic vulnerability of the United States in the age in which we live, the internet age, the globalization of information and so forth, is the vulnerability of that we're seeing, which is people can create doubt, undercut confidence in our election process, and also torque our public discourse in ways that we find hard to perceive. And this has long-term danger for the United States and the survival of a democratic society like ours. And so I hope that whatever the outcome of the Mueller investigation, that we view this as a bigger problem of foreign interference in our elections, which is why I said it was one of my priorities, and it's not just the Russians, it's other countries as well. And we have to focus on that. We have to ensure that we're doing all we can. And I'm not sure all of that is defensive either. I mean, in terms of law enforcement, I think we have to look at all options, including sanctions and other options to deter organized efforts to interfere in our elections.
So you have no reason to doubt any aspect of the intelligence community's composite assessment about Russian efforts in the 2016 election?
I have no reason to doubt that the Russians attempted to interfere in our election.
Senator Blumenthal.
I want to talk about transparency. Will you commit to this committee that you will not allow the president or his attorneys to edit or change the special counsel report before it is submitted to Congress or the public?
I already said that I would not permit editing of my report, whatever report I or whoever is the attorney general makes.
And will you commit that you will come to Congress and explain any deletions or changes that are made to that report before it is issued?
Okay, so, you know, there are different reports at work here. Which report are you? There are two different reports.
The special counsel report.
Okay, well, under the current regulations, the special counsel report is confidential. And the report that goes public would be a report by the Attorney General.
Will you commit that you will explain to us any changes or deletions that you make to the special counsel report that's submitted to you in whatever you present to us?
I will commit to providing as much information as I can consistent with the regulations. Are you saying, for example, that if information is deleted that would be like for classification purposes, I would identify that and things like that?
Well, that you will commit to explaining to us what the reasons are for your deleting any information that the special counsel includes that you are preventing us or the public from seeing?
You know, that would be my intent. I have to say that the rules, I don't know what kind of report is being prepared. I have no idea. And I have no idea what Acting Attorney General Rosenstein has discussed with Special Counsel Mueller. If I'm confirmed, I'm going to go in and see what's being contemplated and what they've agreed to and what their interpretation, you know, what game plan they have in mind.
Will you permit
But my purpose is to get as much accurate information out as I can consistent with the regulations.
Well, the regulations and rules give you extraordinarily broad discretion. And I'm hoping, and I'm asking you to commit, that you will explain to us information that you have taken out of that special counsel report. And I also want to ask you about restrictions on the special counsel. Will you commit that you will allow the special counsel to exercise his judgment on subpoenas that are issued and indictments that he may decide should be brought?
As I said, I will carry out my responsibilities under the regulations. Under the regulations, whoever is attorney general can only overrule the special counsel if the special counsel does something that is so unwarranted under established practice. I am not going to surrender the responsibilities I have. You would not like it if I made some pledge to the president that I was going to exercise my responsibilities in a particular way, and I'm not going to make a pledge to anyone on this committee that I'm going to exercise it in a particular way or surrender it.
Will you allow the special counsel to exercise his judgment as to what resources are necessary? Will you meet those needs for resources?
That would be my expectation. I think, you know, I mean, if you believe the media, they're sort of starting to reduce their resources, so I wouldn't expect that would be a problem.
Will you allow the special counsel to exercise his judgment as to what the scope should be? The president has talked about red lines around finances. Will you allow the special counsel to exercise his judgment about what the scope should be, even if the president says that there should be redlined?
I think the scope of the investigation is determined by his charter from the acting attorney general. And if he wants to go beyond that charter, I assume he would come back and talk to whoever the attorney general is about that.
Will you impose any restrictions on other prosecutors who are also investigating the president? As you're well aware, in the Southern District of New York, the president has been named, in effect, as an unindicted co-conspirator. The Eastern District of Virginia has an investigation that's relevant to the president. Will you impose any restrictions on those prosecutors?
The Office of Attorney General is in charge of the process, with the exception of the special counsel who has special rules applicable to him, is in charge of the work of the Department of Justice.
But you now, have a responsibility to allow prosecutors to enforce the law.
I have the responsibility to use my judgment and discretion that are inherent in the Office of Attorney General to supervise. And I'm not going to go around saying, well, this U.S. attorney or that U.S. attorney I'm going to defer to.
Well,
you referred earlier to
the possibility of firing a United States attorney. Would you allow the president to fire a United States attorney and thereby stop an investigation?
I would not stand by and allow a U.S. attorney to be fired for the purpose of stopping an investigation, but the president can fire a U.S. attorney. They're a presidential appointment.
But the president should have a cause beyond simply stopping an investigation for firing a United States attorney, even if he or she is a political.
Well, as I said, I would not stand by and allow an investigation to be stopped if I thought it was a lawful investigation. I wouldn't stand by for that. But the president is free to fire his officials that he's appointed.
In your experience with the FBI, is it strange to have a counterintelligence investigation begun because members of that bureau disagree with the foreign policy stances of a candidate for president or a president of the United States?
Yes.
The Supreme Court has been unequivocal that the president, in our system of government, the president possesses, and I'm going to quote now, the plenary and exclusive power as the sole organ of the federal government in the field of international relations, a power which does not require as a basis for its exercise an act of Congress. That's the very famous Curtis Wright case. To your knowledge, is that still good law?
Yes.
And do you think that was rightly decided?
Yes.
Let me ask you this. Would it concern you as Attorney General if FBI agents were making decisions about when and how to launch an investigation of an elected official, if it was in order to avoid being supervised or directed by their agency leadership? Would that be concerning to you?
Yes.
I believe you also said that the Mueller report will be confidential. It is confidential under the special counsel's whatever the criteria are. So what I'm hearing you saying that in spite of the fact that you want to be transparent, neither Congress nor public will get the Mueller report because that's confidential. So what we will be getting is your report of the Mueller report, subject to applicable laws limiting disclosure. So is that what you're telling us?
I don't know at the end of the day, what will be releasable. I don't know what Bob Mueller is writing.
Well, you said that the Mueller report is confidential pursuant to whatever the regulations are that applies to him. So I'm just trying to get as to what you're going to be transparent about.
As the rules stand now, people should be aware that the rules, I think, say that the independent, the special counsel will prepare a summary report on any prosecutive or declination decisions, and that shall be confidential and shall be treated as any other declination or prosecutive material within the department. In addition, the Attorney General is responsible for notifying and reporting certain information upon the conclusion of the investigation. Now, how these are going to fit together and what can be gotten out there. I have to wait, and I would have to wait. I'd want to talk to Rod Rosenstein and see what he has discussed with Mueller and what's, you know, what.
But you have testified that you'd like to make as much of the original
right.
report.
And so what all I can say right now is
possible.
Yeah, all I can say right now is my goal and intent is to get as much information out as I can.
Thank
consistent
you.
With the regulation.
Did President Trump instruct or ask you, once you become Attorney General, to fire Mr. Mueller?
Absolutely not.
Did he ask you to interfere in Mr. Mueller's investigation?
Absolutely not.
Has anybody in the White House made that suggestion to you?
Absolutely not.
Can you explain to me again the motivation behind the memo, what precisely you were trying to communicate, just for the record?
Yes, Senator. So the public commentary and media commentary was sort of dominated by discussion of obstruction of justice, and everyone was throwing out obstruction theories and so forth. And the statute that relates to obstructing a proceeding that's not yet in being, that is some future proceeding, is 1512. And my view was of the particular provision, 1512C, was that it requires, what it covers is obstruction by means of impairing evidence, that you know some evidence is going to be needed in a future proceeding and you impair it either by making it not available or by corrupting it in some way, altering it, destroying it. That's what I thought the scope of that statute dealt with. And to my knowledge, the only cases ever brought under it involved the destruction of evidence. Based on public reports, which may be completely wrong, I thought that the it was being that the special counsel may be trying to interpret the statute to say that any act, not destruction of evidence or anything, but any act that influences a proceeding is a crime if it's done with a bad intent. My concern there is that unlike something like bribery statute or document destruction where you prohibit it, that's a bad act. You don't need to be performing that bad act if you're a government official. But if you say that any act that influences a proceeding is a crime if you have a bad state of mind, that's what the people at Justice Department do every day of the week is influence proceedings. That's what they're there for. And what I was worried about is the impact on the department and other agencies. If you say to someone, if you, in supervising a case or handling a case, make a decision for a bad intent, it can be a crime. And I thought that that would essentially paralyze the government. So just to give an example, you know, Eric Holder made some pardon recommendations during the Clinton administration, which were controversial. Incidentally, I supported Eric Holder for his position. Could someone come along then later and say, well, if you did that for a political reason to help Hillary Clinton run in New York, that's a crime? And when he's exercising his prerogatives, you know, in that situation. And you can just see how that could paralyze government. And that was my concern.
You also referred to your concerns with the prosecution of Senator Menendez. Did mm-hmm. that weave into that same thought process?
Yes, because in that case, my concern was that they were basically taking activities that were not, you know, wrongful acts in themselves. You know, the political contributions were lawful political contributions, and the things with you know, the travel on his friend, that was his friend for 25 years. They were taking a trip together, and you take those kinds of things, and then you couple it with official action, and then the prosecutor comes along and says, "Well, we're going to look into your mind and see what your subjective intent was for performing these two sets of lawful acts, and we're going to say, you know, that you're corrupt. Good. So I just think that gives too much power to the prosecutor. And I think if that kind of and by the way, you know, they've had cases like this for, you know, I mean, they've been pursuing things like this and they've had to be slapped down a few times by the Supreme Court on these kinds of aggressive things involving, you know, quid pro quos on the Hill. So
let me, if I can, thank you. I just thought it was helpful because I think you tried to explain a lot of that.
Yeah.
Just a few minor things so that we can get to the next round. There was a report by the Inspector General in 2014 that had to do with accountability in the Department of Justice. I don't expect you to be familiar with this report, but there were some very interesting observations there about a lack of follow-through on disciplinary action for a number of, I think the subtitle of the report was the DOJ could strengthen procedures for disciplining attorneys. It's something I would commend to you and maybe dust off and see if there have been any actions since this report. I didn't get a satisfactory answer when it was contemporary with a nominee from the Obama administration for the position you're seeking, which is one of the reasons why I opposed the nomination.
Actually, I think very highly of Inspector General Horowitz, and I haven't seen that report, but that issue is one that I plan to take up with him.
Senator Grassley.
Do you agree that the Foreign Agents Registration Act is a critical national security and public accountability tool? And if confirmed, will you commit to make sure that that act is a top priority?
Yes, Senator.
Okay. So then getting back to legislation that I think will improve that 1938 act, I introduced the Disclosing Foreign Influence Act to improve transparency, accountability, and enforcement. You haven't probably read that act, but I'd like to work with you, even though it's not in this committee, it's in Foreign Relations Committee. I'd like to have you work with us so it's something that we can pass and make sure that this law is more useful than it has been over the last 80 years. I support the Freedom of Information Act and the public disclosure of government records. Transparency yields accountability. You hear me say that all the time, and that's true no matter who's in the White House. When I was chairman of the committee, I helped steer FOIA Improvement Act into law, which creates a presumption of openness, and that presumption of openness is a very important standard. The Justice Department oversees the federal government's compliance with FOIA. So I hope you would agree that FOIA is an important tool for holding government accountable. And if confirmed, then would you make sure it's a top priority to make FOIA and the faithful and timely implementation of the 2016 amendments a top priority?
Yes, we'll work hard on that.
Senator Feinstein.
In August of 2002, the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel issued opinions authorizing enhanced interrogation methods that included waterboarding and extended sleep deprivation. These opinions were later withdrawn, and the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility found that they reflected a lack of, this is a quote, a lack of thoroughness, objectivity, and candor, end quote. In 2015, I worked with Senator McCain to pass legislation making clear that enhanced interrogation techniques are unlawful and limiting authorized interrogation techniques to those listed in the Army Field Manual. And that is the law today. If confirmed, will you ensure that the Justice Department upholds the law?
Yes, Senator. I think that that was an important change because I think it gave clarity to the law, and I will support that.
Thank you. I'm delighted to hear that. Do you believe that torture is ever lawful?
No.
Is waterboarding torture?
You know, I'd have to look at the legal definition. You're talking about under the, right now, it's prohibited. You know, the law has definitively dealt with that. I can't even remember what the old law was that defined torture. I'd have to look at that and then, you know, figure out what's involved in it. But
Sorry.
Keep going. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's okay, sir.
At what point does interrogation cross the line to the gratuitous barbarity involved in torture? That's your quote.
Well, I wasn't using that as a legal, the gratuitous barbarity. That's what I was I was saying torture is gratuitous barbarity. So I wasn't saying that gratuitous.
Well, that's helpful, yeah. Then.
Sure. Senator Cornyn.
On China, do you agree with me that China represents probably one of the preeminent economic challenges to America, particularly because of their theft of intellectual property and their exploitation of gaps in foreign investment that we've tried to address through improvement of the CFIUS process, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. But talk to me a little bit about what you see the challenge of China, both economically and from a national security standpoint.
Well, I think they're the paramount economic and military rival in the world. I think that they are very formidable because they take the long view. They've been stealing our technology, and they've been gradually building up their military power and investing in new technologies. I think from a military standpoint, it's very disturbing how much progress they're making, largely based on U.S. technology. I was very, I really thought that Attorney General Sessions was right on target in setting up his China initiative in the department to start going after the pirating of American technology and other kinds of illegal activities that Chinese nationals are involved in here in the United States and even abroad.
Do you share my skepticism at Chinese telecommunications companies like Huawei and ZTE in terms of how that once in the hands or in the networks of unsuspecting countries that could be used for espionage purposes and theft of intellectual property?
Yes. In fact, even in my old Verizon days, we understood the danger and would not use that kind of equipment, even though it would be economically attractive.
Senator Leahy.
Just when you just mentioned being at Verizon during the NSA's metadata program, we also had the PRISM upstream. It required telecom internet providers, hand over huge amounts of data to the government. And you testified in 2003 that the law is clear that a person has no Fourth Amendment rights in these records left in the hands of third parties. The third-party doctrine. I actually disagreed with you at that time, and I hope you would now, especially as the Carpenter decision that just came down and written by Chief Justice Roberts, that it says generally requiring the government to get a warrant to obtain geolocation information through cell site location information. Does that change the opinion you had back then?
Well, it sounds like it. I haven't read that decision, Senator. It may modify my views. I'd have to read the decision. I was going on the Miller decision relating to bank records. But also, you mentioned that you were tying this to the NSA collection because and then tying it to my testimony because...
You would say that no person has no Fourth Amendment rights of these records left in the hands of third parties, the third-party doctrine.
Yeah, that was the...
It seems to be undercut by Carpenter.
Okay, I'll take a look at that. But
then would you...
I don't want people to have the impression that Verizon was involved in...
Would you respond
spying
for the record?
Yes, sure, certainly.
And... you said back in November 2017, you saw more basis for investigating the Uranium One deal than the supposed collusion between President Trump and Russia. And by not pursuing these matters, the department is abdicating its responsibility. Just about everybody's debunked the Uranium One controversy. I think probably the nail in the coffin was President Trump's biggest supporter, Fox News, debunked it. Did I miss something in there?
No, actually, you'll notice that there were no quotes around that, and then the next sentence is plural matters. And my recollection of that is what I think it was relating to the letter and the appointment of Huber in Utah to look into a number of things. And the point I was trying to make there was that whatever the standard is for launching an investigation, it should be dealt with even-handedly. Yeah, whatever that trigger is should be applied to all. I have no knowledge of the uranium one. I didn't particularly think that was necessarily something that should be pursued aggressively. I was trying to make the point that there was a lot out there, and I think all that stuff at the time was being looked at by Huber. That's my recollection. I may be wrong on that.
Yes. Senator Durbin.
The one thing I'm stuck on, and many are, is this report you gave to this administration in June of last year about the investigation of the president.
You mean my memo?
Yes.
My memo, yeah.
And you said in there, Mueller should not be permitted to demand that the president submit to interrogation about alleged obstruction. You volunteered that. I'm trying to get around this. Okay. It sounds like it was an effort on your part to ingratiate yourself with an administration which is now nominating you for attorney general. I'll give you one last chance. My time is up. Please respond.
Okay. Well, first, what I was saying there was, again, based on speculation on my part, was that there has to be an adequate predicate. And if he was relying on just the firing of Mueller or the statement about Flynn and this specific statute, those two things, I didn't think it was an adequate predicate. I wasn't saying he may have other facts, he may have other theories that would support it. I was just pinpointing that. Number two, I can assure you I was not trying to ingratiate myself with anybody. The furthest thing from my mind was coming back into government, I can assure you that. And if I wanted to ingratiate myself or signal things, there are a lot more direct ways of doing it than that.
I just, for the record, I think you meant the firing of Mr. Comey. I think you said Mueller.
I'll just take a couple of seconds to see if I can help clarify this, because I think it's been a very interesting hearing. So if there was some reason to believe that the president tried to coach somebody not to testify or testify falsely, that could be obstruction of justice.
Yes, under an obstruction statute, right. Yes.
So if there's some evidence that the president tried to conceal evidence, that would be obstruction of justice, potentially, right?
Right.
Your point is just simply firing somebody, which is a personnel decision, is problematic for the system.
Right, especially if you—what I'm saying is that doesn't fit under that statute.
No, I got
Show
you.
Me some other statute, but that statute, no.
Yeah, okay. Senator Hawley.
Are you concerned about this growing practice of nationwide injunctions by federal district courts, and what do you think ought to be done about it?
Yes, I'm very concerned by it. Earlier, I was talking about this and saying that I think it mistakes the limitation on judicial power, which is a case or controversy limitation, and tries to grant relief to people who are not part of the case or controversy that's being decided. And as you said, it's really started in the 60s, and it's been picking up steam. And the fact of the matter is there are a lot of district court judges, and you can usually find one who somewhere in the country will agree with you. And so major democratic decisions can be held up by one judge nationwide. I'm also concerned that there's another trend, which is the willingness of some district court judges to wade into matters of national security, where in the past courts would not have presumed to be enjoining those kinds of things. And then the appeals process takes a long time, and so a lot of damage can be done before it gets to the Supreme Court and you get a definitive decision. And meanwhile, everything is stuck.
Can you just say more? You're concerned about courts that wade into national security issues where traditionally they have hesitated to do so. Can you just say more about that? What do you have in mind?
like the travel ban. Mm-hmm.
And the concern there is that...
I mean, if the president takes something based on national security and one, and the Constitution vests that kind of judgment for that kind of emergency act or act that he has the authority to perform to protect the country, he's politically accountable for that. And yet a judge with a lifetime appointment sitting somewhere in the country who doesn't have the access to the information, has no political accountability, can stop a national security measure, you know, globally, essentially. And it takes a long time to get that sorted out. That's really troublesome to me.
Senator Whitehouse.
Thank you. Mr. Barr, in order to perform its counterintelligence function effectively, what should the Department of Justice and the FBI know about the business relationships and entanglements of senior officials with foreign interests and governments?
Usually investigations are started because there's some act that comes to the attention of the law enforcement agency that suggests someone is being disloyal to the United States.
Except where
working for a foreign
disclosure.
Excuse me?
Except where we require disclosures in order to give the law enforcement folks that advantage of knowing in advance when a senior official has a business entanglement with a foreign interest or power.
Mm-hmm.
So what should we know?
What official are we talking about?
Well, let's start with the president.
Are you suggesting the president go through a background investigation by the FBI?
No, I'm suggesting that when there's evidence that he has business relationships with foreign interests, then that may be a factual determination that would be of some note to our counterintelligence folks.
Well, the financial disclosures that I think are filed by other—I don't even know if members of Congress file financial disclosures, do they?
Yeah. They do. So do many officials in the executive branch. So
you know, that's for financial conflict. I don't think that's for counterintelligence purposes.
Probably because very few people have business relationships with foreign interest, so it turns up much more often in a conflict.
Well, business relationship with a foreign interest is not ordinarily a counterintelligence concern.
Unless, of course,
the person is a traitor.
Or in a position to make decisions that are biased or influenced by those business relationships.
Well,
counterintelligence and treason are not the same thing, are they?
Counterintelligence, you're usually trying to counter the intelligence activities of another country.
Correct. And you may want to head off things. You may want to be aware of things. You may want to... There are a whole lot of things short of treason that are the counterintelligence function.
Right. Including, you know, counterintelligence focuses usually on foreign intelligence services and their activities. I think we're mixing apples and grapes or whatever here because
Just having a hard time answering what ought to be a really easy question, which is that when a senior government official has business relationships with foreign interests and powers, we ought to know about it. That ought to be an easy proposition, and in any other administration it would be.
Well, did congressmen go through background investigations to get access to classified information?
That's a whole separate question.
No, but it's exactly the same question.
We do a lot more reporting than we do.
Well, your financial reporting, with all due respect, is not the same as a background investigation. You're elected by the people to hold an office, and you know, you don't get a background investigation to get on the Intelligence Committee.
But we do have to do a lot of reporting. Okay, you don't want to answer it. I'll move on. Let's talk about corruptly. Mm-hmm. In obstruction cases. I'm not sure I heard you correctly, so I want to make sure you have the chance to explain. But it sounded like you were saying that the word corruptly, used, as you said, adverbially, was a requirement that there be some form of destruction or interference with evidence. I have always read that term corruptly in obstruction of justice to impose an intent requirement, which is also what the Criminal Resources Manual of the Department of Justice says and what I think virtually every appellate court has said. So it worries me if what you are trying to do here is to redefine the obstruction statute by narrowing the intent requirement and using the term corruptly to refer to something very different, which is the actual physical corruption changing or
damaging. I think I kind of lay your concerns.
Can you,
yeah.
Could you do that? Because
if you read, if you look at the memo, you'll see that my discussion of corruptly is not up in the plain meaning section. We're talking about how you interpret the statute. And my basic argument as to why the statute covers destruction of evidence and hiding evidence and stuff like that is based on the word otherwise. The Supreme Court decisions in Yates and Begay, also the fact that if you actually read it otherwise, it swallows up all. It becomes a one-clause
it
wipes out everything else.
If I can just cut to the...
No, so then later on I point out in my memo, I later point out that that reading is also supported by the understanding of the word corruptly, which the Poindexter case, D.C. Circuit case, I think had the most intelligent discussion of the word corruptly, which is it does refer to the kind of activity that's necessary, which is perverting a proceeding by corrupting it.
So in the event that the Mueller investigation has turned up evidence of obstruction of justice by the president or people close to him, you would follow the Department of Justice's existing legal guidance with respect to what that word corruptly means?
My interpretation of the statute was not predicated entirely on the word corruptly. I was just pointing out.
And it is not your intention to change
department
policy or department standards or department definitions, particularly as they may bear on obstruction by the president or people around him.
That's right.
Thank you.
I'll recognize Senator Klobuchar.
In your previous confirmation hearing for Attorney General, you stated that the Attorney General is the president's lawyer. You have also said that the Attorney General's ultimate allegiance must be to the rule of law. So I'm going to characterize that as the people's lawyer. And there have been times throughout our history, including during Watergate, when the personal interests of the president do not align with the interests of the country. In those critical moments, is the Attorney General the people's lawyer or the president's lawyer?
Well, the reason I referred to the Attorney General as the president's lawyer is because in 1789 they said that the Attorney General is to provide legal advice to the, mm-hmm. the president
yes.
and the cabinet, and that's in their official capacity. And my view on that is that, like any lawyer, you give the best advice as to your view of the law. If the president determined that he wanted to do something that you thought was still a reasonable construction of the law, even though you might not have decided that way as an Article III judge, just as you support congressional enactments that are reasonable, you do the same for the president.
Mm-hmm. But how about in a situation like Watergate?
So, you know, if the president directs an attorney general to do something that is contrary to law, then I think the attorney general has to step down.
Okay.
It's that simple.
Thank you. Under the special counsel regs, the special counsel must send a second report to Congress documenting any instances where the AG prohibited the special counsel from taking an action. Will you follow those regulations and send the report to Congress?
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Coons.
You've declined, or I'd say refused, to commit to following the advice of the career ethics officials at DOJ with regards to recusal from the ongoing special counsel investigation. Will you at least commit to notify this committee once you receive the ethics officials' guidance? Tell us what it was and explain whether you agreed or disagreed with it.
To tell you the truth, Senator, I don't know what the rules are and what the practice is, but, you know, off the top of my head, I don't think I would have an objection to that.
So you'd be comfortable letting us know that you'd received an ethics opinion and either declined to follow?
But I'm not sure what the practice and the rules are. I generally try to follow the rules.
You said earlier in this hearing you have an interest in transparency with regards to the final report of the Mueller investigation. But I didn't hear a concrete commitment about release. And I think this is a very significant investigation. You've Yes. been very forthcoming about wanting to protect it. The DOJ has released information about declination memos, about descriptions of decisions not to prosecute in the past. I'll cite the Michael Brown case, for example. Would you allow Special Counsel Mueller to release information about declination memos in the Russia investigation as he sees fit?
I actually don't think Mueller would do that because it would be contrary to the regulations. But that's one of the reasons I want to talk to Mueller and Rosenstein and figure out, you know, what the lay of the land is.
But if appropriate, under current regulations, you wouldn't have any hesitation about saying prosecutorial decisions should be part of that final report.
As I said, I want to get out as much as I can under the regulations.
You also...
I think that's the reason I say it's vitally important. Right. It's related to my feeling that it's really important to, you know, let the chips fall where they may and get the information out.
You also said in response to my first round of questions that the special counsel regulations shouldn't be rescinded during this investigation. Just to be clear, you would refuse to rescind them if the president asked, even if that meant you'd have to resign?
Well, that came up in the context of wanting to change the rules so Mueller could be fired.
Right.
Where there was no good cause.
No good cause, correct.
And I said there, yeah, I would not agree to that.
There's another ongoing investigation in the Southern District of New York in which I would argue the president's implicated as individual number one. If the president ordered you to stop the SDNY investigation in which someone identified as individual one is implicated, would you do that?
Well, that goes back to an earlier answer, explanation I gave, which is every decision within the department has to be made based on the attorney general's independent conclusion and assessment that it's in accordance with the law. And so I would not stop a bona fide lawful investigation.
So if the president sought to fire prosecutors in the Southern District of New York to try and end the investigation into his campaign, would that be a crime? Would that be an unlawful act?
Well, I mean, that one, usually firing a person doesn't stop the investigation. That's one of the things I have a little bit of trouble accepting. Mm-hmm. The basic point is if someone tried to stop a bona fide lawful investigation to cover up wrongdoing, I would resign.
Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein has said publicly your memo had no impact on the special counsel investigation. If you're confirmed and you're supervising the special counsel investigation, would you order the special counsel's office to accept and follow the reasoning in your memo?
I would probably talk to Bob Mueller about it. If I felt there was a difference of opinion, I would try to work it out with Bob Mueller. At the end of the day, unless something violates the established practice of the department, I would have no ability to overrule that.
You were Attorney General when President Bush pardoned six administration officials charged with crimes arising from the Iran-Contra scandal, and you encouraged the president to issue those pardons. Is it permissible for a president to pardon a member of his administration in order to prevent testimony about illegal acts?
Is it permissible under what?
Would it strike you as obstruction of justice for him to exercise his presidential pardon power for the purpose of preventing testimony?
I think that if if a pardon was a quid pro quo to altering testimony, then that would definitely implicate an obstruction statute.
Would it be permissible for the president to pardon family members
simply
because they're family members?
Let me say that. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Two last questions, mm-hmm. and then we'll be done.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it would be permissible for the president to pardon a family member simply because they're a family member, and where the purpose, the motive is unclear? And do you think it would be permissible for a president to pardon himself?
Yeah, so here, the problem is, under the Constitution, there are powers, but you can abuse a power.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to your question, in my opinion, would be, yes, he does have the power to pardon a family member, but he would then have to face the fact that he could be held accountable for abusing his power. Or if it was connected to some act that violates an obstruction statute, it could be obstruction.
How would he be held accountable?
Well, in the absence of a violation of a statute, which is, as you know, in order to prosecute someone, they have to violate a statute. In the absence of that, then he'd be accountable politically.
Senator Blumenthal.
On the pardon issue and accountability, you would agree that the president pardoning someone in return for changing his or her testimony would be an abuse of the pardon power, and the president should be held accountable.
And, well, a quid pro quo to change testimony could potentially be obstruction.
Or for not testifying at all,
mm-hmm.
would be obstruction of justice. The special prosecutor or the prosecutor anywhere else came to you with proof beyond a reasonable doubt of that kind of obstruction or any other crime, talking proof beyond a reasonable doubt, would you approve an indictment of the president?
Yeah, that's the kind of thing I'm not going to answer off the top of my head. But if we take it out of this context and say, if a prosecutor came and showed that there was a quid pro quo by which somebody gives something of value to induce false testimony or
it would be a crime.
Yes.
And the question is whether the president could be prosecuted while in office. I happen to believe that he could be, even if the trial were postponed until he is out of office, but because the statute of limitations might run for any other number of reasons, a prosecution would be appropriate. Would you agree?
Well, for 40 years, the position of the executive branch has been you can't indict a sitting president.
Well, it's the tradition based on a couple of OLC opinions, but now it is potentially an imminent, indeed immediate possibility, and I'm asking you for your opinion now, if possible, but if not now, perhaps at some point.
Are you asking me if I would change that policy?
I'm asking you what your view is right now.
I actually haven't read those opinions in a long time, but I see no reason to change them.
Well, I'm happy to continue this conversation with more time and another opportunity.
Sure.
I want to ask you about the Southern District of New York, which I believe is as important as the special prosecutor. As I mentioned earlier in my question before, the president has been named there, individual number one, as an unindicted co-conspirator. If the president fired the United States attorney, would you support continuing that investigation, even under the civil servants, the career prosecutors who would remain, assuming it is a legitimate prosecution?
Yeah. And I've tried to say it in a number of different ways. I believe, regardless of who or what outside the department is trying to influence what's going on, every decision within the department relating to enforcement, the attorney general has to determine independently that that it's a lawful action. And if there was a lawful bona fide investigation that someone was trying to squelch, I wouldn't tolerate that.
Putting it very simply, you would protect that investigation against political interference, as hopefully you would do to the
with any investigation in
exactly.
the department.
Let me move on to something unrelated, if I may. In the early 1990s, thousands of Haitians tried to flee persecution in their own country by coming to the United States by boat. As you will remember, you oversaw, I believe, a program that sent thousands of them, some of them were HIV positive, mm-hmm. to Guantanamo Bay.
Mm-hmm.
These asylum seekers were kept at Guantanamo Bay for 18 months. A federal judge in the Eastern District of New York described the living conditions in Guantanamo Bay by saying that asylum seekers were forced to live in camps, quote, surrounded by razor barbed wire, end quote, and compelled to, quote, tie plastic garbage bags to the sides of the building to keep the rain out, end quote. In an interview in 2001 at the Miller Center, you defended this program. Do you have regrets about it now? And am I correct in saying that these asylum seekers first started coming to the United States, it was your position that they should be kept there indefinitely?
I really appreciate the opportunity to address this. So in 1991, Aristide was overthrown in Haiti, and there was a sort of a mass exodus from Haiti. And up until then, the policy of the United States had been forced until that time, had administrations had forcibly returned Haitian asylum seekers and so forth without any kind of process. It was a humanitarian problem because a lot of these boats were sinking. It was a 600-mile journey. So the Coast Guard, there are two different issues. One issue is the processing of those who are healthy, and the second issue is the HIV. In a nutshell, the processing, we started actually giving them abbreviated asylum hearings on the ships. Eventually, we moved some of that to Guantanamo, and we were admitting to the United States 30%, which is the highest it's ever been. I mean, I think before that, it was just minuscule. Later, when the Clinton administration adopted our policies, it went down to 5%, I am told. But in any event, then it became so overwhelming that we forcibly repatriated the Haitians because we felt that most of them, the conditions were changing. We didn't think that there was a threat in Haiti, and we were just overwhelmed, and we forcibly sent them back to Haiti. Meanwhile, HIV was an exclusion. You could not admit anyone with HIV, and this was adopted by the Senate. And then in the first year of the Clinton administration signed a bill that kept it as exclusion. You cannot admit someone with HIV except by case-by-case waiver based on extreme circumstance. So what we did with the HIV people is we first screened them for asylum, because if they couldn't claim asylum, then they wouldn't be admitted. And then we started a case-by-case review. I started admitting them on a case-by-case basis where cases could be made that there was a particular reason for doing it, like pregnant women and people who had not yet developed full-blown. I think there was a slowing down of the processing because people felt that the Clinton administration, which at the time was attacking these policies, was going to be more liberal. And so people thought, well, why should we go through this process with Bush when Clinton's right around the corner? Clinton came in, adopted our policies, and defended them in court, continued forced repatriation, continued the exclusion of HIV. As part of settling a case, he brought in 260.
Which didn't necessarily make it right.
Well, it was right under the law.
Did you favor keeping those Haitians in Guantanamo indefinitely?
No.
And we were, ask you,
I think most of the articles at the time said we were sort of in a catch-22. We were trying to process the HIV people on a case-by-case basis. And in fact, the lawyers who we, by the way, agreed to have lawyers come down and represent these people in the asylum hearings at Guantanamo. And in the book written by them, they say right out, we were making progress. It stopped when the Clinton administration was elected. So we were in this catch-22 on the HIV, and I had staff members go down there to Guantanamo, and they did not report, you know, inhumane conditions or anything like that. And that is not mentioned, I don't think, in the book written by the lawyers who represented them. So it was a mass exodus situation, and we did the best we could.
Would you do it again in exactly the same way if you had it to do again?
I mean, I don't know. It would depend on the circumstances and also depend on whether we thought this was really a case of persecution.
Let me ask you this. Would you again house asylum seekers in Guantanamo?
Well, the Clinton administration did. In fact, they doubled, and they started putting other nationalities in there, too. Probably not because of the associations of Guantanamo now.
All right. A couple of questions by Senator Blumenthal. We're going to wrap it up.
You were asked by Senator Leahy about your statement that the Uranium One deal was more deserving of investigation than collusion with Russia. You answered that you were not specifically referring to the referencing the Uranium One deal, but just generally referring to matters the U.S. attorney might be investigating.
I can't remember the exact context of that. There was a series of questions a reporter was asking, and then the article sort of put them in a sequence that didn't necessarily show my thoughts.
Well, the New York Times just published in a tweet the email that you sent them, and you did reference Uranium One specifically. I'll ask that it be part of the record.
Not objection.
What did I say?
The tweet from Peter Baker of the New York Times says, questions have been raised about what Bill Barr told us for a story in 2017. Here is his full email from then responding to our request for comment. We're grateful he replied and hope this clarifies any confusion. And the email from you says, and I will take the relevant part of the sentence, quote, I have long believed that the predicate for investigating the uranium deal, as well as the foundation, is far stronger than any basis for investigating so-called collusion.
And what came before that?
I'll read the full email with the permission of the chairman. Peter, got your text. There is nothing inherently wrong about a president calling for an investigation, although an investigation shouldn't be launched just because a president wants it. The ultimate question is whether the matter warrants investigation, and I have long believed that the predicate for investigating the uranium deal, as well as the foundation, is far stronger than any basis for investigating so-called collusion. Likewise, the basis for investigating various national security activities carried out during the election, as Senator Grassley has been attempting to do. To the extent it is not pursuing these matters, the department is abdicating its responsibility, signed Bill Barr.
Right. So the abdicating responsibility was, I was actually talking about the national security stuff, and that was my primary concern. The Uranium One deal, the sort of pay-for-play thing, I think at that point, I may be wrong on this, but I think it was included in Huber's portfolio to review, suggesting that there was something to look at there. But the point I was really trying to get at was that there was a feeling, I think a strong feeling among many people, that it appeared, at least on the outside, that there were double standards being applied. And I thought it was important that the same standard for investigation be used for all matters. But I have no, you know, specific information about Uranium One that would say that it has not been handled appropriately.
Well, that's really my question. What was the factual basis for your saying that the Uranium One deal was more deserving of investigation than Russian collusion, given what you have articulately described as the potential threat to the national security of the United States from Russian interference in our election?
Yeah. I think at that time there was a lot of articles appearing about it. I think maybe Congressman Goodlatte had written a letter about it. So there was smoke around the issue, as there's been smoke around a number of issues that have been investigated. But I was using it really as an example of the kinds of things that were floating around that some people felt had to be looked in as well, looked at
so
as well.
The factual basis was whatever that smoke was.
Well, the public information that a lot of opinions are being formed.
And how about as to the foundation? What was the basis of your claim that the foundation was more deserving of investigation than Russian collusion?
I didn't necessarily think the foundation was should be criminally investigated, but
you did say that in the email.
I did? Criminally?
Well, let me read that part of the sentence again. I have long believed that the predicate for investigating the uranium deal, as well as the foundation, is far stronger than any basis for investigating so-called collusion. You were referring to the criminal investigation, as I read it.
Well, the foundation, I always wondered about it was the kind of thing that I think should have been looked at from a tax standpoint, and whether it was complying with the foundation rules the way a corporate foundation is. And I thought there were some things there that, you know, merited some attention. But I wasn't thinking of it in terms of a criminal investigation of the foundation. I'd like to, you know, Attorney General Mukasey said something that I agree with. He said, it would be like a banana republic putting political opponents in jail for offenses committed in a political setting, even if they are criminal offenses. It's something we just don't do here. And one of my concerns, frankly, is, you know, politics degenerating into, you know, this kind of thing about should we investigate this, investigate that, about political opponents, and that concerns me. But so that's why I said, I think, in if not that, some other article, I don't subscribe to this locker-up stuff.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please give the Lawfare podcast a 5-star rating and a review wherever you listen to it. And share the podcast on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you tell everyone about your favorite audio programming. This episode was edited by me, Elena Kagan. And though we don't have music on special editions, if we did, it would be performed by Sophia Yan. Until then, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.